for coming here. So I will discuss the general idea that the accelerated expansion of the universe that we are observing today in the sky could be a result of breakdown of standard laws of gravity at very large distances. Now, there is an enormous literature on this subject. These are some of my key collaborators, and then there's many other references. Now, this is, because this is a colloquium, so I'm sorry, I will display Friedman equation, although everybody knows what it is. So this is Friedman equation. Is there a pointer, by the way?
You can use the
pointer. Oh, you can. Okay. non-traditional way, but anyway. So this is Friedman equation, as you know very well, which is the main cosmological equation that tells us how the universe expansion goes on as a result of gravity responding to a source. And H is a Hubble parameter, which essentially tells you what is the rate of the expansion of the universe. And A is the scale factor in the FW metric. Now, the way this Friedman equation is written normally, of course, it has left hand side and right hand side. And normally, the way we write it, we put gravity on the left hand side, yeah, and then matter on the right hand side. So basically, this, the way it is written, it tells you how gravity, H squared, responds to the energy budget in the universe. And now, this energy budget consists of whatever is there in the universe, energy density budget. Now, the point is that the current observations coming both from supernova and from FITS to CMB, they tell us that the universe is, we are entering in the epoch of accelerated expansion. Essentially, what is happening is that H is approaching a positive constant. So now, the point about this equation is that if you use as a source, in the left-hand side, anything that gravitates as a normal matter that we know, like matter or radiation or something like that, there's no way to get accelerated expansion. Because for accelerated expansion, you need something which normal matter doesn't have. It's a negative pressure. Okay. So therefore, there are two options. Either to explain observations, you have to modify left-hand side and put another source with a very unusual source with a negative pressure, okay, something like a cosmological constant or quintessence. It must be tiny. Or you have to modify the left hand side and so modify gravity. And so my discussion will be about approaches that modify gravity. So the left hand side of this equation. Now, the most important thing when you do this, so now, I will discuss fundamental points. Basically, I will try to understand whether fundamental, from what we know about fundamental physics, about fundamental gravity, such a modification is viable. And if you are a field theorist who operates in normal notions like degrees of freedom, Hilbert spaces, norms, propagators, etc., the first important thing that you will understand when you try to write down a modified gravity theory on the blackboard is that there is a discontinuity. So what I mean under this discontinuity? Basically, you naively you may think in the following way. That, okay, so here is my Einstein section. And as a field theorist, the way I can think of the corrections, modification of gravity at large distances, I could think as corrections, some small corrections to Einstein, which will then eventually become dominant at very large distance. So I would assume that there is an action, Einstein's action, plus corrections that are suppressed by some large crossover scale. So this crossover scale in my talk I will call RC, R critical. So I'll take that. So this is one parameter in those theories. I will take this R critical to be 10 to 28 centimeters, the current cosmological horizon. So naively, you would think that, therefore, if you are at short distances, much shorter than the size of this modification, naive modification, so gravity should be almost Einsteinian. Or actually, in the limit, when you take RC to infinity, you should recover Einstein's gravity. And actually, this intuition is completely wrong. And this is the key point about these theorems. The point is that no matter how weak are corrections to Einstein, so basically, how can you understand this? The point is the following. In GR, there is a messenger of gravitational interaction. So this messenger is graviton, and it has it's a spin 2 massless particle. It's a particle with spin 2 and no mass, zero mass. Now, you can turn around this argument, and you can say, okay, suppose somebody came and told you, I have a theory of gravity in which a messenger is a massless spin 2 particle. So then you know that that theory of gravity cannot be anything other than Einstein, or it's inconsistent, okay? So basically, the theory, GR, is unique nonlinear theory, which has as a messenger a massless spin 2 gravity, okay? Now, from here, it follows automatically that if you have any theory which modifies gravity at large distances, the messenger in that theory can no longer be a massless spin 2 particle. It has to be something else. So in other words, graviton cannot be a massless spin 2 particle. So graviton should have new degrees of freedom. Now, the normal graviton, massless graviton, has 2 degrees of freedom. If you have a gravitational wave, it has 2 polarizations, like the electromagnetic wave. The moment you modify gravity, this stops to be true. Okay? And so that's the discontinuity, because degrees of freedom, they are not continuous. They don't come and go with some parameter taken to zero. They stay there. So once you change theory, these degrees of freedom stay there. So this is a very important message, that the moment you modify gravity, the graviton stops to be a massless spin 2 particle. Typically, actually, so what happens, it turns out, in those theories, graviton becomes some kind of a resonance. It has to become some kind of resonance. Otherwise, theories are non-consistent. Okay? So in other words, you can take graviton and expand it to continuum of states. Which means that it acquires extra 3 polarizations. So basically, degrees of freedom in those theories are, instead of 2, they are actually 5 or more. Okay? And this is very important. So there is this discontinuity. Now, I'll come back to this issue. This will play a central role in all the observations and stuff that I'll discuss. Now, you can ask the following question, all right? Why should the modification of gravity necessarily explain accelerated expansion of the universe? Okay, why are we even expecting that should happen, okay? And here's the reason why. Now, in gravity, if you have an universe, in gravity, if you have a universe with a constant age, universe with constant positive age is the same as universe with constant positive curvature, scalar curvature. This is just an identity, right? So therefore, the way you can think of the acceleration of our universe today, right? We have accelerated universe. We can think in the following way, that actually the universe is filled with a tiny, tiny scalar curvature, okay? So the expectation value of a scalar curvature is non-zero in the universe, okay? And it's tiny. Now, the converse is also true. Whenever you have a space where you have a constant scalar curvature, positive scalar curvature, that space is a space which describes accelerated expansion, or the Sitter space. Okay? So therefore, in some sense, not in some sense, in a direct sense, the producing accelerated expansion of the universe is the same as producing a positive scalar curvature, okay, tiny scalar curvature in the whole universe. Now, in some sense, it's a direct sense, there is a graviton condensate. In our universe, there is a tiny graviton condensate. The expectation value of R is graviton condensate, just in the same way as when we have electric field in this room, that is a photon condensate. Many photons in some coherent state, okay? Now, on the other hand, in physics, we know that massless bosons, they do not condense unless you have a source. Right? So in this room, if you want to create a photon condensate, you have to have a source. Either you should have a charges, or you should have something else. If I switch off this power, the photons will disappear. The only thing you will get will be the waves. So there is no bosonic condensate without a source if bosons are massless. This is well known. So now it's sort of almost trivial to understand why in GR, impossible to get accelerated universe without a source. Because graviton is a massless boson, it cannot condense in GR unless you put a source. So if you want to create many gravitons in a coherent state or a constant curvature, so you have to put a source. And that's why we need dark energy in Girac. Okay? But in modified gravity, the story is different. Because as I told you, the moment you modify gravity, graviton stops to be a massless spin two particle. It becomes a resonance. It acquires something like a mass. Actually, it's a superposition of many, many massive gravitons. So, but massive bosons, they can condense without any source. Right? If you have a scalar field, for instance, which is massive, that scalar field can oscillate, and that's a condensate. Okay? So therefore, the moment you give mass or something like a mass to a graviton, the graviton can condense on its own. There is no reason to have any dark energy which sources. And that's the key point. So what happens in modified gravity theory is the way you see this effect on Friedman equation is that the Friedman equation gets corrections. Nonlinearities in H squared, or the lower powers in H squared. So therefore, gravitons can condense on their own, because this obviously has a solution with H constant, without any external source. Okay? So that's the physical reason why you immediately expect, when you have modified gravity theory, that something you should have some solutions on its own, which would give you some constant curvature or something, or nearly constant curvature or something like that. Okay. Now, the next question I want to ask, now I want to go to fundamental theories of which do that. And I want to ask the following question. Now, of course, we want to be motivated with some fundamental theories, which probably are quantum theories of gravity at very short scale. So the question is, how could, the naively would ask the following question, right? How could the theory of gravity, which is a fundamental theory at very short scales, could modify things at large distances, right? Typically, short-scale physics is associated with some heavy states, you know, and they don't do anything at large distances. We know physics, there is this decoupling principle, right? That short-distance physics cannot affect large distances. Now, so this is the question you should ask in any theory of fundamental quantum gravity, which has some potential to modify things at large distances, okay? Now, in particular, so in string theory, the way this could happen is through extra dimensions. So again, there is this idea. So by the way, the fact that I told you that in any modified gravity theory, graviton should look like a resonance particle, which means that you can think of the graviton as some collection of bunch of continuum of states. Okay? This automatically tells you that somehow extra dimensions probably should be involved in any modified theory of gravity. Because the continuum of states sort of cries for it, right? And the way extra dimensions come in our understanding is through the states. So if you have infinite number of massive spin two states, then that works like extra dimensions. When it's like extra dimension, it is an extra dimension in a sense, right? In some sense. If you have a question, sure.
What if I have the cosmological constant? Why is it zero?
Let's go step by step, right? let's first understand whether you can modify gravity at large distances. Then we come to this question, okay? So the way in string theory this could happen is because you have extra dimensions in string theory. And or in any other theory of quantum gravity in which you have extra dimensions. So there is this idea of brain walls. I mean, I think it's people know it very well. So the idea is that we live on a three-dimensional surface, or effective three-dimensional surface, and all the conventional interactions, they live on the surface, but gravity lives everywhere. Okay? And so, for instance, like, I don't know, then from once you adopt this concept that we may be living on a brain in extra dimensions, you can imagine all possible crazy ideas which are not ruled out. For instance, like, I don't know, if we live on this brain, so let's say we can be living here, and there may be a star which looks like a distant star, a very distant star, because the light travels through the brain, but actually at the same time you can make a shortcut through gravity, through extra dimension, and the same object may be, well, it cannot be in this room, we would see it gravitationally, but it can be in our galaxy, okay? Anyway, so this is... Now, in string theory, this picture is very natural. Now, again, my talk is not necessarily related to string theory. It would, for me, would define any theory that predicts extra dimensions and predicts this kind of thing. Okay? But in string theory, this is especially natural, this kind of situation. Why? Because in string theory, as you know very well, right? What is the concept, fundamental concept of string theory? The fundamental concept is that there is a string. So the fundamental object is a string, and all the particles that we see around us come as vibrations of the string, essentially, right? So now, if you have nothing to do and you want to write down a string theory, you will realize immediately that strings can be open and can be closed, okay? And then you go on, and you understand that at least in some incarnations, which I want to focus on, of string theory, those open strings, they should live on brains. They should be attached to the brains, the so-called D-brains. Again, many people know this in this room very well. And now, what is the key point? The key point is that if we listen to these vibrations of these closed strings and open strings, if we quantize them, we will find out that the massless spin 2 state with the graviton in whatever dimensions you are is only coming from the closed strings, cannot come from the open strings. Everybody else could come from open strings. So this picture is very natural, that all the ordinary interactions, they live on subspaces, and gravity lives everywhere because it has no legs to be attached to brains. Okay? I mean, this is just one simple thing, but of course you can do much more sophisticated constructions when you can use megabrains and warp spaces, etc. Now, what is important? So basically, in this picture, what is happening, right? This, if we had a very powerful microscope, okay? If we look at normal, let's say we see a wave that we should throw, right? If I look at this wave in a very powerful microscope, or the powerful accelerator, to say I would see a vibration of a string, probably the lowest line vibration of a string. If I had a less powerful microscope, I would see some collective motion of strings. And if we don't have any microscope whatsoever, then we just see a wave. Okay, so that's the way, essentially, what we see as waves and ordinary particles on the surfaces are essentially vibrations of the string. Now, before going to cosmological stuff, let me mention the following thing. That, of course, physical theories, they only make sense if essentially we can test them, right? At some point, you want to be able, at least in some thought experiment, to be able to test those theories, right? Now, the great thing about this idea of extra dimensions, of these large infinite extra dimensions or whatever, is that, or any extra dimension essentially, is that eventually you should see it in the colliders. Why? Because the point is that if you are confined to a surface and you collide particles above certain threshold, you should see some stuff going out in the bulk. Okay? And therefore, these accelerated experiments are the natural arena for understanding this, so for testing this kind of ideas of modification of gravity, because immediately anything that requires extra dimension eventually should show up at the colliders. Now, unfortunately, I don't have time to go into technicalities, but there are good reasons to think that there is a big class of models in which you modify gravity, the class is the same, but I mean it's a big parameter family of the models, motivated, in which you will see this kind of effect at the collider. So essentially what you will see is that you will see in string theory language, when we are colliding particles, we are colliding open strings. So you collide open strings and then you produce closed string which goes away in the bulk. And that's what we should see at the colliders. And you know very well this the largest microscope we have is this upcoming microscope is LHC. So that will allow us to resolve distances of something like 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, something like that. And the question is whether we will see this, some of these effects of the extra dimension at those colliders. So if not, then the huge class of the models would rule out, and that's already great because, you know, physics, we are in the business of producing theories and then ruling them out, right? this was the tunnel. I mean, many of you have seen it, this accelerator tunnel. This is Atlas, I think, experiment. So the however, there is another universal thing about gravity, that gravity penetrates everywhere. Because it penetrates everywhere, and the reason why it penetrates everywhere from the string theory explanation is because it's made out of closed strings, which have no legs. Eventually, it should show up in the modification of the Newton's law, of the Gauss law, right? Because Gauss law in 3 plus 1 dimension tells us that Newton's force is 1 over r squared. But if you have extra dimensions, which are infinite, or cosmological size, then eventually you should see modification of Newton's law at some distances. That's inevitable. That's another very important thing. Now, let me discuss a model which so far, I mean, it's a class of models, but they have this common property. And so far, this is the only known class of consistent models which modify gravity at large distances. Again, the point is that it's always good to have one example when you discuss general things. Now, what I will say, essentially the features that I will discuss, what I will say, this belongs to, these features would be, you can apply them to any modified gravity theory, essentially, okay? I'm just discussing on a concrete example, because that's the only known example, essentially. So, now, what is this example about? This example, we are living on this three-dimensional brain, and let's say you have a source of some gravitational wave, I don't know, some binary or supernova or whatever, and there is a gravitational wave emitted. And what happens to this gravitational wave? And it turns out what happens is that this gravitational wave compromises. For some distances, it travels like a 3 plus 1 dimensional wave. And then after that, it starts leaking in the extra dimension. Okay? Now, physically, you can understand this by a simple physical analogy. Okay? So imagine the following situation. Imagine you have some two-dimensional surface. Okay? Let's say, I don't know, to take this table. Some metallic surface or something, infinite, okay? And let's submerge it in some lower density medium, okay? Let's take this table and put it in the water or whatever, or air. So now imagine that you have some two-dimensional creatures that live on this surface, okay? And these two-dimensional creatures, they can only communicate by sound waves, so sending sound waves on this surface, okay? So the question is whether these creatures will eventually discover extra dimension. And the answer is yes. At the beginning, when their devices are not so good, they can only measure sound waves near the source. So if you take a hammer, if you knock this with a hammer, you will produce sound waves. Now, if a creature which lives on a two-dimensional surface can only measure the sound wave near the source, this sound wave will look like dissipation of this sound wave, the energy dissipation will look like almost two-dimensional. Okay, but if you go farther from the source, eventually the dissipation into extra dimension will become noticeable, right? Because there is water, so some of the energy goes into water. Eventually you will discover the extra dimension, but you will discover extra dimension because you have something missing in your dimension. So Gauss law tells you that it should be like whatever, log of r in 2 plus 1 dimensions, and you discover that it's not log of r. At large distances becomes like 1 over r, the potential, okay? So essentially, we may be in this situation right now, that we are communicating with gravity, and this gravity, like sound waves, at short distances, it lives on the two-dimensional, or this three-dimensional surface, but eventually it will escape in the extra dimensions. Now, again, from the point of view of field theorists, what is happening in this theory is that gravity requires a lifetime. Okay, if I'm an intrinsically 3 plus 1 dimensional observer, okay? Then, for me, the way it would look like as if graviton acquired the lifetime or the width, right? Because now it can leak into extra dimension, but I cannot see extra dimension. My devices are 3 plus 1 dimensional. So what my devices will detect is that graviton acquired the lifetime, became a resonance. Now, this lifetime is huge. It's the size of the universe, essentially the age of the universe. Now, of course, now, so this also tells you why at short distances you see normal gravity. Why? Because, so for instance, when we are orbiting around the sun, right? So we are orbiting around the sun. What are we doing? From the point of a field theorist, what we are doing is that we are continuously exchanging virtual gravities. Okay? So we are, in a sense, playing tennis with virtual gravity between sun and the earth. Now, if you play tennis, right, any tennis ball has a lifetime, right? But you don't notice it when you play one game, because lifetime is much bigger than the average duration of your game. I don't know, maybe there are games which last longer than lifetime, but anyway. So that's exactly the same effect. You don't notice that the graviton has lifetime because the distance, the sun Earth distance is very small. Much smaller compared to the mean life path of the graviton. Okay, so that's what happens. Okay. Now, so this theory, this modified gravity theory, because of this existence of these extrapolarizations and because of all this that I've discussed, they are extremely constrained. And this is very different from the dark energy, because models of dark energy, unless they are very sophisticated, they indirectly somehow relate to some particle physics models. Dark energy, you can always fit observations, but you cannot constrain it by anything other than cosmological observations, because dark energy has no dynamics. A priori, it doesn't have to have any dynamics which couples to us, okay? So modified gravity theories are very different because of this fact that the moment you modify them, you modify gravitational dynamics at any distances. So at all the distances, basically, okay? So now, there are three directions in which these theories can be tested. So one I already mentioned, this LHC colliders. The second is cosmology, precision cosmological measurements. And the third class of measurements is precision gravitational measurements at short scales. Now, let me discuss cosmology briefly, okay? So let's say we are observers which live on this 3+1 dimensional surface. And we have no idea about extra dimensions. All we can do, we can go out and measure the expansion rate of the universe. By doing observations, cosmological observations, distance to luminosity surveys, supernova surveys, and the other fields, cosmological fields, we can effectively derive effective Friedman equation. Okay? So the question is, how will this effective Friedman equation will look like? The way it will look like is that the way it looks like is that all the information about this extra dimension, the fact that graviton is not really 3+1 dimensional, but it also knows about extra dimensions at large distances, appears to be encoded in a correction to the Hubble square term, which goes linearly with Hubble. Okay. Now, there are some corrections also to that term, but in leading order, you can use this result. And actually, for a three-level theory, this is an exact solution. Okay, classical theory. This is an exact solution. So now you see what's happening, right? That the early cosmology is almost normal because when H is much larger than inverse RC, the first term dominates. But then cosmology becomes inevitably affected by 100%. Now in particular, this particular thing has a self-accelerated solution. And there is no need of dark energy in this particular case. Okay. Now, the way you can differentiate this from the dark energy theories. Now, again, you see, there is only one parameter, RC. There is one parameter and essentially continuum observations. So what you can do, and I know people in this room actually are experts on that. You can do three different things, like distance to, so for instance, this is an example of distance to supernova, sorry, distance to luminosity supernova curves. And you see that, of course, they are different. So for instance, for dark energy, like simplest models of dark energy, the cosmological constant, and in this theory, they are different because of obvious reasons, because the transition is smoother in these theories, because you modify a Friedman equation instead of modifying the source. So now, error bars, currently error bars are big enough to accommodate both theories, but eventually they will shrink. So eventually, we will know which ideas are correct. Okay. Now the second class of observations. So then there is the whole series of fits to supernova. The CMB fits. And again, I unfortunately don't have time to discuss that, but these are very important works, and people in this room, some people in this room are really much more experts on this than I am. So now, the second class of observations is the precision gravitational measurements. Okay. Now, what is this about? So here's the point. As I said, in these theories, because you modify gravity, you end up with new degrees of freedom. new polarizations of gravity. There's no chalk, but anyway. So the new degrees of freedom, new polarizations of gravity. So gravity in normal Einstein sphere, gravity, as I said, has two polarizations, right? So here we have additional three. And these three I can split in 2 plus 1. It's not very difficult. But but this one, so basically how I split it. So these are two tensorial polarizations, two tensorial degrees of freedom. And these are, this is three massive vector degrees of freedom in a sense, which you can split in two vectorial degrees of freedom and one helicity zero. Okay, so this helicity zero, the zero helicity state, is the most important one. Because it turns out that the zero helicity state exhibits what we call a strong coupling phenomenon. So these gravitons, these longitudinal polarizations of gravitons, they are much more strongly coupled than the normal ones. Okay? And this is a key effect. Now, this is a very interesting effect. And actually, it's a key point in all these theories. So basically, you can prove that, you can forget about this model that I was discussing. This. You can prove that any modified gravity theory must have this you can prove it like a theory. It must have this property. Okay? Now, because of this, what is happening is that in any modified gravity theory, the sources, gravitating sources, they are endowed by a new horizon. So in GR, we have one horizon, right? So if I have a source, there is the Schwarzschild radius, right? So in theories of modified gravity, there is a second horizon. Well, horizon in the quotation marks, because that second horizon is the horizon for extra degrees of freedom, not for us. We can still go through it. The problem is for extra degrees of freedom to go through it, okay? So therefore, this is the summary of how a gravitating source in any modified gravity theory would look like, okay? So forget this for a moment. So this is the picture. So let's say you have a source with some mass m and the Schwarzschild radius gr, rg. So this is a Schwarzschild radius. Now, then there is an intermediate scale, r star. We call it r star. So this is this new horizon that I was talking about. Now, this scale r star is source dependent. So r star is usually between the gravitational radius of a source and the whatever scale you have input in the theory which modifies gravity at the cosmological scale. So inside this r star sphere, the gravity is Einsteinian gravity. Okay? So if you have a source which is smaller than its own r star, gravity is almost Einsteinian inside that source, inside r star. Outside r star, corrections are 100% important. Now, if you want to look for the solutions of the gravitational equations, so inside this sphere, this r star sphere, you can look for the solution in perturbation theory of r over r star. So r over r star could be your expansion parameter. You cannot use g Newton as an expansion parameter inside this sphere. Just in the same way as in normal Einstein's gravity, you cannot use g Newton as an expansion parameter beyond the horizon. At the horizon, this expansion breaks down. And outside r star, you can use an expansion parameter g Newton. So in other words, there are two regions. In one, you can use as an expansion parameter Newtonian coupling constant. In the other, you have to use this scale r star, and then they merge. Okay? Right there, either you know solution exactly, or you don't know it simply, because there is no perturbation theory. There is no known perturbation theory which works for the sources whose size is right at their r star. Okay? So for those sources, predictivity breaks down, or if you want to study some perturbations there near those sources. Yeah?
You say any modified gravity theory,
but John Bernstein theory is modified gravity. No, I'm talking about modified gravity theories. Who could explain accelerated expansion of the universe? Of course, I can trivially introduce. Jordan Bernstein theory is not really a modification of gravity. You are introducing additional scalar outside. Of course, you can always introduce additional stuff. I'm not calling that modification of gravity. I'm calling modification of gravity theories that modify dynamics of spin too, and which are imposed upon you by general covariance.
So that's a specific type of modified.
That's what modified gravity is, right? If I introduce a scalar, that's not modification of gravity. Then you are introducing a scalar. Then standard model is also a modification of gravity because I have a fix. But we don't say this, right? Because
modified gravity theory is more than just
well, I don't want to go into the semantics, but this is what I'm saying is strictly rigorous. So, no, not for me. This is a general thing, because if you believe in analyticity, unitarity, and positivity of the norm, then you can prove this. Now, of course, again, I'm saying you can always introduce some new degrees of freedom by hand on top of it. And of course, you can call it modification of gravity, but that's not really gravity. Well, okay, that's semantics now. So this, that's fine. If you want to call it, that's fine. But I think it's well. I think you understand the class of theory that I'm discussing is very well defined. Okay? But of course, this is these remarks are absolutely correct. Yes. So for instance, if you have new degrees of freedom which are weakly coupled, which have to do nothing with acceleration of the universe, of course they can exist. There's no problem. I mean, you can have some new scalars or new vectors or whatever. That's absolutely.
From this kind of theory, you can derive an acceleration.
I don't believe so, unless you have both. We can talk later. Sure, we can talk later. But anyway, so what I'm saying is that so now this is very general. Now, the precise relation between R star and RC, of course, is model dependent. And so again, as I said, this is the only known model I know of this type of modified gravity. So I don't know. Maybe there are no other models. Maybe there are. So for them, there will be something different here. But for this model, this is the geometric mean, the R star. So essentially, so the way you can think of it is that every gravitating source carries a certain umbrella around it, this shield, I don't know what you want to call it, this R star radius. And inside R star, the gravity is almost Einsteinian with small corrections. Okay. Outside R star, gravity changes by 100%. And so then this means that now you can go and measure. So you tell me what is your favorite source, gravitational source. And I'll tell you what will be the modification of the gravitational potential near that source, and we can confront it with observations. The formula goes like, well, it's obvious from here, but let me write it. So the relative change in the gravitational potential goes like this: r divided by 28 centimeters, square root from r over rg. Okay, so r is the distance at which you want to do your measurement. Okay, so now you tell me what is the source, which means that you specify this, and then at a given distance, the relative change of the gravitational potential will be given by this equation, by this equation. Okay, so for instance, Rg for the sun is like something like what is it? It's 3 kilometers. So for the Earth, it's like a few centimeters, etc. Okay, so and now we can go and see what is going on with this. What are the predictions of this theory? Now, the predictions are that there will be anomalous corrections to the motions of planetary orbits. So in other words, the most sensitive thing that you can detect is the anomalous precession of the planetary orbit. Okay. Now, it turns out that if you take this equation and if you play around with numbers, pretty interestingly, I mean, for Jupiter, for instance, right? The corrections to the perihelion precession of Jupiter are pretty close to the existing bounds, like factor of 13. So when we saw this, we got very happy because, you know, for theoretical physics, so somebody, you know, doing the, I don't know, standard model field theory, sim theory, factor of 30 is nothing, right? So then we talked to experimentalists, they told us it's completely hopeless because nobody's planning anything for Jupiter. So, but then Eric Adelberger was visiting actually NYU, and he told us to look for the moon. Why? Because for the moon, there are experiments which are ongoing, and actually they apparently, it turns out that they are very sensitive. Now, if you recalculate this thing for the moon, what you will get is that approximately you will get 10 to the minus 12. And the current accuracy for the moon is 10 to the minus 11. So the perihelion precession for the moon, for the lunar orbit, so these numbers are here. So this is the predicted one. And today's accuracy is this. So, well, you see that it's like pretty close. And the good thing about the moon is that there are experiments that are ongoing. There is new generation of improved accuracy lunar ranging experiments, and which I'll discuss in a second. And these are really very exciting experiments. Now, what are these experiments? What they do, they shoot lasers to the moon. Okay, so now the idea is that and then on the moon, on the surface of the moon, there are mirrors, so-called retroreflectors. So this is the these are the cells of unit cells of these retroreflectors. Now, basically, the idea is very simple. The idea is that imagine that each unit. So imagine that the corner of this room were made out of mirrors. Okay, so you have like three mirrors which are interperpendicular. Okay, now if corner of this room were made out of mirrors, then it would have the following geometric optics property that if I shoot a laser, no matter from where I shoot it, it will come straight back. Okay, so that's the idea. So you shoot laser to the moon and it returns to you essentially with some small correction, of course. And in this way, they can monitor the lunar orbit. These mirrors there were brought by these people, the Apollo 11 mission, and this guy. and so the current accuracy is already amazing. So if I translate this accuracy, 10 to the minus 11, I mean this one, this accuracy, if I translate to the in centimeters, essentially today we know the lunar orbit by up to 1 centimeter accuracy. So it's really amazing. So we know how moon moves with 1 centimeter accuracy. So if they go down, so they think that they can go down to a millimeter. If they go down to a millimeter, they can rule out this model. Just flat rule it out.
For example, with the period of Jupiter, the problem is not so much the observations, but it's like the perturbation theory from everything else, and all the other planets and asteroids and everything.
Yeah, of course.
Because actually, the precession, most of it is not due to the LHC effect.
Yeah, of course.
So maybe in this case, it's the same problem. We need to know where everything is in the solar system.
Right, so
it's not just
No, you are absolutely right. So, absolutely right. So, one of the reasons why it's very hard to improve anything about Jupiter is precisely that you have a lot of perturbations which you cannot control.
But you're saying in this case it's under control.
Well, this is what they say. I don't say that. So I believe that because I had a lot of discussions. And this is a fair question. It's really amazing when you think about precisely what you said. It's really amazing how important and how delicate these experiments are. Because now you would say, okay, there are kites on the Earth. I mean, everything, right? So everything, solar winds and stuff like this. Everything should affect this measurement. Actually, there are two factors that are helping you. Of course, one factor is that they have a great software so that they can. The second one is that the moon is very heavy compared to anything that is born from satellites. So, for instance, this is one of the reasons why anything human made is completely hopeless for this kind of measurement. Because the disturbances from the solar wind and stuff like this would be so important for them that, I mean, you can forget about it. So, what saves you is that moon is heavy. And so the moon is heavy and it's close enough to us. And then also we are light enough. I mean, the Earth is light enough. So therefore, the combination of these factors is what helps you. And I mean, this is really amazing. These experiments are really amazing because even if anything, right, even if they don't see anything. First of all, if they don't see anything, they would rule out big class of modified gravity models, which, and we will know that they are not responsible for the acceleration of the universe. So, secondly, I mean, we have measured Einstein's gravity up to 10 to minus 12 accuracy, which is again amazing. I think these are historic experiments, very important. So the main people they are Chris Stubbs, Eric Adelberger, and Murphy, and so this is like Washington, Harvard, whatever this combination. And so it's very exciting because these results are. I mean, already the fact that by looking at the moon, you can derive some information about the acceleration of the universe, already that fact is pretty interesting and impressive. Now, again, this is moon. and the third class is, of course, measurements, CMB measurements, and fits. So there is a enormous literature. People are doing different fits of to the background, and again, as I said, many people here are much more experts than I am. That's another very important direction. So basically, the point is the general message is that. So now, to finish my talk, I want to deliver basically discuss two issues. So one is a general message that these theories, because they have new dynamics in them, they are testable, and they are testable by combination of measurements. Of course, I mean, if tomorrow they, for instance, they go out and see that there is some anomalous precession of the moon, Will there be, of course, there won't be a proof of modified, that the same modification, of course, it will be proof of modification of gravity. It will not be proof that the same modification is responsible for the acceleration of the universe. It will give a very big support for it, but of course, we have to measure independently. We have to do supernova surveys, we have to do, CMB fits, and only in complex, in combination of these, you can either kill theories or proof theories, right? The second issue that I want to finish with is theoretical, because, it's theoretical, but it affects observations, as usual, right? So, now the thing is that this concept of R star, let me write it here. So, can everybody see this? Okay. So, as I said, right, there is this very important concept of R star in any theory of modified gravity, and this is very general. You can prove it at the level of a theory, okay, without specifying a model, underlying dynamics, whether it's extra dimension, whatever it is. So the thing is that there are two types of sources. There are sources which are, actually there are three types of sources. So the first category are the sources for which, let's say this is the size of a source, okay, R. So there are sources for which are much smaller than their own R star. And these sources are completely under control, okay? Because you can compute the correction to gravitational potential, you can compute the spectrum, you can compute everything. The second category are the sources for which R is much bigger than R star. And again, these sources are fully under control because here you can do expansion in G Newton and there is no problem. You can linearize gravity works, everything is smooth and fine, and you can compute the spectrum. There is a third category of sources which are for whom the size is of order R star. And these are the most problematic ones. Because here, both perturbation theories break down, okay? And so from inside out, this is R star. From here, I can do R over R star expansion. And from here, I can do G Newton expansion, or in this, which is the same as RG over R expansion. But here, I cannot do any known expansions. So here, you need some other more powerful methods to analyze this, what is going on for those kinds of sources. Now, There were a series of incorrect papers because sometimes people are trying to take sources like our universe and apply perturbation theory to the universe. But universe is the one source that is exactly of its own R star size. That's the definition, right? Because modification of gravity for a given source becomes important when source grows to its own R star. So for the universe, everything is of the same size, right? Because it's a universe. So for universe, Rg is equal to H0 is equal to Rc and equal to R star, because that's the definition of the universe. So the problem is that for the universe, we don't have powerful methods to analyze perturbation theory.
Yeah, when? But the universe is not always the same.
No, today. Today
is the definition today.
Because that's what we're looking for, perturbations we're looking today, right? That's the problem. Well, that's the problem. Well, it's not a problem. But
suppose you're looking...
No, every cosmology is completely under control. That's the whole point. So back in the past, exactly. But that's a very good question, actually. That's a good question. Because you see, so this is the R star of the universe, which is given by this, right? So back in the past, universe was smaller than its own R star. So therefore, every cosmology is completely under control. We know everything about it. The problem is today, we know the background, but we cannot do perturbation theory about the background. So you need some powerful non-perturbative methods to really understand perturbations and stuff like this, okay? I mean, you can make some guesses. People are making some guesses.
Yeah, I mean, by your argument, one couldn't do perturbation theory of the event horizon of a black hole, but people do that all the time because there's another small parameter, which is the size of the perturbation.
Very good, yes. So that's precisely my point, because there you managed to find a small parameter. So I'm looking forward for somebody.
The small parameter is the metric is dimensionless, so the small parameter...
No, metric is not small. At the horizon, metric is of order 1. That's the definition of the
parameter. The perturbations are small. The small parameter is, the background metric plus alpha times the perturbation, where alpha is the small.
No, of course. Let's distinguish two things, right? Perturbations are always small. That's the definition of perturbation, right? You take metric, right, and you say that by metric I can write as something big plus something small.
So if you have an exact equation and you have an exact solution.
Of course, but in Einstein gravity, those perturbations are weakly coupled. Here the problem is that those perturbations are strongly coupled. That's the problem. And when you are dealing with a source, this is a very profound and key problem in this theory. Because when you have a source which is of order of its own R star, there, the small perturbations, you cannot say that they are weakly coupled. So you have to resum the whole series. Now, You can easily sum this whole series when you have small sources. For them, there's no problem. People have done it, I mean, there's a summation, and you know the answer. For big sources, again, perturbation theory is perfectly valid. That's precisely the problem. So exactly. So, well, first of all, thank you for your question, because that's eliminates, so that actually illuminates the difference between Einstein gravity and this kind of theories. That exactly, in Einstein gravity, I have horizon, the perturbation theory in RG over R breaks down, but graviton itself is weakly coupled. But here, no, the extra polarizations of graviton are strongly coupled. That's the difference. Okay?
Just as an initial thought, I mean, you said it was by definition that they're all equal, but it seems to me it's like kind of fine-tuning in which you set this value of
this discussion is not about fine naturalness. This discussion is about dynamics, right? So,
I'm just saying it's not by definition.
No, but it's by definition, because as I said, right, once you fit one observation for RC, it's fixed. So then the rest is fixed. Right, there is no room.
Yeah.
What do you mean fine tuning? I'm fitting the observation.
Okay, but it's by choice of parameter in the theory. It's not by definition of those constants. It's by
you are choosing parameter in the theory because that's what nature tells you that parameter should be. Yeah. But if, by the way,
it's
but
not by the definition of the parameter, it's by the fact that you compare it with.
Of course, yes. I mean, what I'm saying is that this parameter. So let me confront to continue on your question. Let me confront this. Actually, again, an important remark, because let me confront this with dark energy situation. Okay, I'm not addressing cosmological constant issue. We compare this with dark energy. Now, the thing is that this, of course, in both cases, there is one number that you have to choose. There is nobody came up so far with anything that tells us what this number should be precisely. Okay.
Well, there is some projection.
Okay, let me not go there. I'm sure we can go forever. So this number. But there is this issue that you said, fine tuning. Actually, here is different because this parameter is not UV sensitive. The dark energy is UV sensitive. If I compute correction loops to the dark energy, I get renormalization, which is and Planck to the fourth or whatever. This parameter gets no corrections. RC is an infrared scale. It's like a temperature. It doesn't get any corrections. That's another, by the way, I forgot to mention it. That's another interesting point about modified gravity models, that infrared modification scale is UV stable by sort of by default, because it's an infrared scale of your theory. Okay? So there is a key difference again there. But I completely agree that, of course, in both cases, you have to choose parameters. I would love to have a third case where theory would tell you this is the dark energy period, but unfortunately, okay.
It's been a folklore of gravity that a mass of graviton always has negative energy costs.
Massive graviton doesn't have
negative negative.
If you have exact mass eigenstate, yes, that's right. Yes,
so, absolutely. Is it true that self-accelerating solutions of these modified gravity theories have ghosts?
No, that's what I was trying to say, because that's the whole point. Because to see that there is a ghost here, unfortunately, or whatever is here, right, you self-accelerate the branch is exactly the branch at which you are doing perturbation theory about the source for which this perturbation theory is not valid, period.
So
that's precisely the point. So this
gravity theory is stable on that line.
No, we don't know. But there is a difference between don't know and say having a ghost, right? I mean, we don't know, unfortunately, because that's the limitation of this. That's the limitation of this dynamics. Unfortunately, nobody came up with any powerful method, to control sources to do perturbation theory about the sources which are of the size of this R star. And there was this whole debate in the literature, back and forth, people were computing, somebody was saying there is a ghost, somebody was saying no. And frankly, I don't know what they are doing, because this perturbation theory is not valid, period. Whether you find here positive or negative answer, none of it can be trusted.
Did Einstein know that he produced such an incredibly robust theory when he published it?
Einstein?
Yeah.
Probably he suspected.
He probably didn't know it.
That it was a robust theory,
yeah.
But he knew that it was generally covariant and it was unique from that requirement. I don't know. But that's a historic question. I'm not a historian, so anyway. So maybe I should finish here and take questions, whatever they are.
Any questions?
Yeah. I'm kind of confused about the connection between these parameters to the ones with the large ISA dimension that you mentioned earlier. So does this scale RC somehow relate to the radius of the ISA dimensions, or is this a completely independent parameter?
I don't think I discussed the radius of extra dimensions. In my talk, I was discussing extra dimensions with all models which are relevant for accelerations. And so those models, by default, they should have at least one dimension, which is either infinite, the infinite volume, not warped, not non-compact, truly infinite. I mean, infinite volume, or at least the size of the horizon. So all my discussion was about those non-compact infinite volume extra dimensions. Now, you can, of course, on top of them, you may have the compact ones. That's a whole separate story. But in my reference, there was no reference to the radius of extra dimensions. So now, maybe what may be useful for you is that actually the most well-studied model is when of this sort is the one with one extra dimension, infinite. Okay, and in that case, the RC. There is no theoretical bound on RC, essentially. It could be pretty, pretty large. Okay. Now, it turns out that if you have two or more, any number of extra dimensions, which is more than one, so then RC has to be a geometric mean between, again, these theories are not very well studied. So this is the whole thing related with technicalities and, you know, regularization and stuff like this. But anyway, so far, the answer that came out is that the RC is the geometric mean between the Planck scale and the quantum gravity scale. Okay. So therefore, in those theories, RC. By the way, this also in those theories, if this is correct, if those theories make sense, if those theories make sense, this is correct. Sorry. So if those theories make sense, then RC is fixed, and just by experiments. To be of the size of the horizon. Because the quantum gravity scale cannot be lower than the inverse millimeter. We know that from the experiments in the lab. Right? So therefore this fixes the RC to be the size of the horizon. But again, this is in those theories which are not very well understood, so I don't want to refer to that.
Yeah, I was just wondering what reason do you have to think that this scale is time independent?
I don't have any reason for that. No, absolutely. No, I don't have any reason for that, to believe that this scale is time independent. Absolutely. So, there were papers in which people are promoting this scale into the time dependent quantum. Sure, yes, there is no reason for that. Yeah. I mean, in the minimal model, it is time independent, but of course, you can go beyond the minimal one. So for instance, back in the past, this RC would have been smaller. Sure, yeah.
But that would change everything about the early universe and stuff.
Well, you have to try not to, but I mean, yes. So if you give me the model with which RC is time-dependent, I'll tell you what happens there. But in this context that I was discussing, RC is not time-dependent. It's just a constant. If you can go beyond that, that's absolutely... absolutely interesting, and I encourage you to do that.
So. The return to my question, why is the cosmological constant zero?
Well, why is the cosmological constant zero? The answer is we don't know, and I don't think anybody knows. And so as I said, my discussion was about dynamics. It's not about naturalness. What I'm saying is my dynamics. Nothing that I said in this discussion is guided by naturalness. It's guided by unitarity, analyticity, and dynamics. So in some sense, if you wish, you can view this as a necessary properties that any modified theory of gravity should have. Okay? These are necessary properties. Now, I'm not saying they are beautiful, they are ugly, they are natural. That's a separate story. That's a separate thing. These are the properties that any theory will have, and these properties will allow you to test them. And why is cosmological constant zero? That's a very good question. I agree. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there were original ideas. I mean, what we were hoping that maybe modification of gravity one day could tell you why cosmological constant is why this renormalized part of the cosmological constant is zero or whatever or very small. These are still under study, and I don't think people have complete understanding of those. But, yeah.
You said unitarity a couple of times. Are you talking about unitarity in the higher dimensional theory?
No, full theory should be.
If you have things leaking off to the most, then how can you?
No, that doesn't break unitarity. I mean, that's okay. As long as full theory is unitary, that's fine.
You're talking about full theory. What was your answer?
Unitarity is a consistency required, right? So, I mean, if I take this out.
Unitarity for the effective theory, for the four dimensional theory, or unitarity for.
Of the full theory.
Yeah.
Full theory should be unitary. So, now.
Higher dimensional theory. You're putting the general theorems about the four dimensional effective theory based on unitarity for the higher. Dimensional theory? Is that the
point? I don't think so, because if your dimensions are infinite and non-compact, I mean, look, obviously I can take this out of this table, right, and take it away. Yeah. Now, somebody who lives on the surface of this table will think that this is lost forever. But there is nothing ununitary about this, right? I just removed things from one place to the other. So there may be seeming violations of unitarity, but those will be suppressed by 1 over RC. But the full theory I'm requiring to be unitary.
Yes,
go ahead. So do you need extra dimensions, or you can have some other mechanism that explains the extra polarization?
Right, so that's a very good question. Now, of course, you see, there is this whole history behind it. The simplest way to modify gravity at large distances would be simply to postulate the graviton has a small mass, right? Now, unfortunately, it seems that, I don't know if it's a complete rigorous mathematical proof, but I think it's an excellent, there are excellent arguments to believe that you can never construct a theory with finite number of massive spin two states. So if you have massive spin two states, you need always they should come in infinite. So which means that you need certain continuum of those. Because now if you are dealing with modifications of gravity at large distances, you need mass to be small and spacing to be tiny. So in a sense, you are led to that. So you are led to this conclusion that graviton has to be.
But under which assumptions, though?
The unitarity and analyticity, again, same thing. Absence of ghosts, unitarity and analyticity. That tells you that you cannot construct, there are no theories of finite number of massive spin twos on asymptotically flat backgrounds or asymptotically residual backgrounds. Now, in asymptotical ABS, story is a little bit different. Although even there, it's not completely clear, but I mean, there is story different. So that's why, so in some sense, it's true that you are sort of left to extra dimensions. Even if you don't want them, they are sort of upon you because since you are led to this value, you must have infinite number of degrees of freedom. The most natural framework in which you have infinite number of degrees of freedom is the extra dimension and string theory or whatever. Yes.
So this is a two-part question. What is the reason why I can't have a finite number of massive
gravitons? It's again ghosts.
It's again ghosts.
Yeah.
So how does having an infinite number fix if that is? Couldn't I just have a situation where the theory has an infinite number, but there's a sector where only a finite number are excited, and then the effective description of that would lead you back to sector?
I think that's impossible because, again, this is a good question. If you will find a loophole out of those theories, it would be great, but I think they are a bit rigorous because essentially what happens is the same as in Kautz-Klein theory, right? So remember, these are old arguments that you cannot have Kautz-Klein theory truncated. If you truncate, you end up with ghosts. So you always need the full tower of, and this related to the fact that when you truncate a theory, you are sacrificing general coherence. Truncated theory cannot have a general coherence. So then breaking general coherence explicitly leads you to ghosts. So that's the story. So it's the same reason, actually. So if you have a linearized theory of massive gravity, there's no problem, but the nonlinear theory, you need non-linearities and you need them to be generally coherent because gauge symmetries are the only way to get rid of ghosts. But when you have infinite number of states, what they cure problems of each other. It's the same as in string theory, right? String theory has infinite number of high-speed states. Now, single high-speed state, you can never write a consistent theory, interactive theory of a high-speed state in four dimensions. But infinite number, they can be consistent because they cure problems of each other. It's the same reason. So in this way, when the graviton is resonance in this theory, what happens is the different constituents of the graviton, they cure the problems of each other. I mean, which from the high dimensional point of view, it's seen immediately because it's just a high dimensional theory. There's no, nothing like nothing fancy.
Yes.
So few years ago, there were arguments that I guess are now been reassessed, but there were arguments that you couldn't add any degrees of freedom to the graviton without getting sort of order one effects, even in the solar system.
Exactly, that's the discontinuity that I mentioned. So that is this whole
How does this get around those arguments?
So yeah, so there is this whole history to that subject, and I mean you can give two talks actually about it. The point is that, but it's very interesting. So historically, what happens in the 70s, I think it was 71 or whatever, Wardan, Deltman, and Zakharov, it's called BGDZ, discontinuity, they came up with this exactly this remark. What they noticed is that if you have a linearized theory of massive gravity, then it has 5 degrees of freedom, and this, because you have extra scalar attraction, so they concluded that any theory of that sort would be ruled out because it contradicts solar system observations. Now, what they missed was the strong coupling. Because they were discussing linearized theory, they missed this point that there's a strong coupling theory. And this was discovered in like a few years ago, like with binomial groups, but first was discovered by Arkady Weinstein, Gregor Gabaladze, Cedric Defaye. Nobody else and myself. And then there were other groups that by now there is no question about that. We know that the massive gravity or any other theory of quantified gravity is strongly coupled, has this strong coupling effect. And that's why their result, this discontinuity, you cannot use it to apply to solar system observations. Because solar system is within its own R star. Actually, even in the 70s, there was an immediate objection by Weinstein, who also said that this could not make any sense because of nonlinearities. I mean, he was not formulating in terms of strong coupling or anything like that, but he basically showed it at the level of equations. He showed that there is a scale, we call it Weinstein's radius, which is sort of reincarnation of R star for massive gravity, which at which the perturbation theory breaks down.
You said that. That line, you don't know that the theory is stable.
Yeah, of course, that knowledge knows.
So it's not a rigorous proof.
Of what?
That the nonlinear theory gets you around the entire government cycle of problem.
No, well, this is not. No. We find that the
discontinuity.
No, there's no discontinuity. This is just. You know that here corrections are small. That you know, that you can prove. It has been proven, and there is enormous literature of exact solutions, actually, where people see it, and you can see it. Now, what I was saying is that here, unfortunately, I don't know how to do perturbation theory. That's all I'm saying. Maybe there is an additional problem, but that problem will have to do nothing with the BGDZ discontinuity. This will be a new problem. If there is a problem, there will be a new problem.
Expected gravity is almost weak. It's 40 orders of magnitude smaller than.
No, that's the whole point. Not in modified gravity theories. No, that's the whole point. Because in modified gravity theories, you can prove that there is a strong coupling. And that's inevitable. So, either modified gravity theory is ruled out the moment you wrote it on a blackboard, or it must have a strong coupling. There is nothing in between.
Okay, I think we've had enough questions. Thank you.